G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Whitey, good morning.
Good morning, Harf. Some interesting stories today to talk to, whether it's Thomas Randall or... really looking forward to catching up with Brad Kennedy, because he almost gave the game away at the start of this year and then had an unlikely win at the New Zealand Open. And all of a sudden, at 46, 47 years of age, things are starting to sort of open up for him again. So, looking forward to having a chat to him and many other things, I'm sure. It's a shame we're not at Flemington this morning.
Hang on a second. You've gone through basically the entire program there, and you haven't mentioned Cameron Green once. Is that because you don't overdo it too early? You don't get the juices flowing too early?
To be honest, I didn't sleep very well last night. Emma told me, can you please stop talking about him? Just give it a rest. I was sort of a bit of pacing. I couldn't sit still. The excitement levels were palpable. And I just needed to just not think about it.
Are you going to be okay? Like, do you want me around just to sort of guide you through
it? I'll need your support. I'll be a mess if you're not there. I'll probably embarrass myself. he's a very young man, Daniel, is Cameron Green. I think
he's 21?
Yeah, he's still a bit shy and, I don't want to sort of make him feel uncomfortable. So I think it's important that you're there.
Righto. I'll balance it out a touch. I'll call him.
But don't embarrass me either, because if you go too hard about things, he'll think we're a bit, or me particularly, a bit strange.
So
I know I am anyway, but, just be a bit careful.
What happens if he doesn't pick up this morning? It doesn't happen.
No, he'll pick up. I know he'll pick up.
Righto. Just checking.
He's a good boy.
He's a good boy. Goodness me. We're in trouble early. But you were saying about Flemington, Whitey.
Yeah, it's a shame we're not there. I mean, last year particularly was such a beautiful morning. It sort of hits home about all the things that are not normal. And I talked about this a couple of weeks ago when we were meant to be at Caulfield. And then even last week we were meant to be at Moonee Valley. But Flemington was so spectacular last year. And... it's a shame. It's a real shame. And the races are going to be so good. And we know that. And even through the entire pandemic, we've had great racing to watch on the couch. But I sort of hit home hard yesterday, seeing some of the horses that are going to be working at Flemington this morning. And often, almost every day, they work at Flemington. But this is the day that we're usually out there sitting in the hill stand. All the trainers come up and it's exciting. And to not be there is a bit disappointing, that's all.
I agree with you, by the way. I think we have different reasons for our disappointment this morning. You seem to like pay more attention to the fare that's on offer at Flemington, which is quite exotic and quite delicious. And the number of hot chocolates that seem to come your way when Matt Stewart floats around, he's a excellent hot chocolate getterer, is our man Matty Stewart. And I think that's what you're missing a bit more than the rest of us, although the bacon and egg roll at Flemington is something else. I don't know what they do with the egg or the bacon, but it's something else. It's different. It's different at Flemington.
I agree with you. It is outstanding.
It's different.
It is outstanding.
So tell you what else is outstanding. You've started the show without a hat.
Yes.
There's been an incident.
Yes.
Has redemption occurred? Have you been to see Cindy?
There is a story of redemption. It's a bit emotional, to be honest, because what I've learnt over the weekend, Daniel, is that you've got to give people a second chance. And sometimes you give people a second chance, they really respond. And I spent a bit of time thinking about it, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to give Cindy another chance.
Wow. This is remarkable.
Yeah.
First conversation go? How did it go, that first consult?
Oh, she was nervous. She was very nervous. I think she knew that last time... as I said, she was overconfident. She probably just didn't put the time in, didn't think much about it, went through the motions. And I think things have clearly changed because the shop's been shut for such a long time and she hasn't been able to ply her trade or do her craft. And I think she's had some time to think about it. I asked her what she'd been doing. She said she'd been sitting on the couch watching a lot of movies. And I think she's got a much better appreciation for, you know, when she sits someone down in the chair and cuts their hair, that she's got a responsibility not to go through the motions. And she was nervous. We had a chat about it beforehand. A few things were brought up from last time, and I think she responded.
Oh, wow.
Was it a good haircut? No, it wasn't. It was only fair. But she's improving.
Oh, no.
It's heading in the right direction.
I think she's done a good
job. She forgot to thin it out with the thinning scissors. Now, that's on me. I didn't request that.
But how do you thin out steel wool? I mean, it's difficult.
It is very difficult, but you've got to do it. Otherwise, you're going back a lot earlier than you need to be. But as Emma said afterwards, she said, well, if you don't ask the question, how does she know when it comes to thinning scissors? And I said, well, if you're an experienced hairdresser, then you just know these things. That should just be innate. You shouldn't have to be responding to questions. It should just be happening.
As anyway, John Ralph would say with Gareth Hall on RSN Central, look, it's a good point.
The key is that she's heading in the right direction. I've given her another chance, and I think I'll go back again, but she's gone one last chance. If next time it doesn't get better again, she's not learning.
They are hairdressers.
It's a lovely story.
You've got to talk to them. You've got to talk to her, yeah. Or Cindy. Give her a chance. Give her a chance. Oh, I think she's done a great job. You look sharp. Very sharp. And you're out and about now. You're free. On November 8, you'll be free. You'll be able to wander the state like nobody else's business. You'll be able to get out there and just drive 26Ks and feel comfortable and feel no tension or stress. And you'll be able to do what you like. All within social distancing, really, of course.
Yeah, it's not really quite that good, but it's better.
Oh, you're not happy?
Well, as I said, it's not normal.
Well, no, it's COVID normal. It's different. It's different. Yeah. Off the SMS, I can imagine the Green interview, Cameron Green, coming out from WA after 8 o'clock, will be like Bruce McAvaney interviewing Cyril after he's ridden Winx to a fifth Cox plate. That's very funny. That's a great start to the morning. And then Tomo. Oh, no. Dino Sullivan's going to be upset. Morning, Half and Whitey. The mighty Royal Bower is running in the last today at Swan Hill at 5 p.m. She'll run ever consistent as she does. Love your show. Love the early mail. Cheers, your man Tomo in Ballarat. Now, poor old Dan O'Sullivan, he puts the polish on these horses magnificently. And then blokes like Tomo spruik them on air and they just put the mocker on them and they can't win from that point in time onwards. He might as well be scratched at the moment, the mighty Royal Bower. That's what Dan O'Sullivan's listening at the moment.
If we can't get a winner today with Nathan Hobson with about 28 runners, we're in trouble.
I reckon we'll get a winner. He's got to get the right one.
Yeah, that's true too. That is true too.
A little bit later on.
That is true too.
Now, Rick Kelly announced his retirement yesterday too. Just a little tidbit that I want to chat to Rick too. I think he's got a really good story in the world of supercars through his times. Started in, 2002? I think he started his first supercar championship. Well, it might have even been 2001. It's a good story because they took a risk, the Kelly brothers, and in about 2013, when they took on the Nissan, they got Nissan back into the category, leaving the safety of the Commodore, and they did a bloody good job, the Kelly boys, and I wouldn't mind catching up with him this week, but he's signalled his intention to farewell a full-time drive in supercars from next season onwards, so we'll see what happens with Rick, but we'll try and get him on at some stage this week.
A few changes.
Yes.
Looks like it's going to be very different next year. Yeah. Like we thought of that when it came to the fact that Holden weren't going to be involved and all that sort of thing, but it's certainly become a lot more dramatic than just not having Holden, with quite a few changes and to some of the big teams and obviously the fact that Scotty McLaughlin's not going to be there, it is going to be very different. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, a lot of chairs up for grabs, or seats up for grabs in the supercars for 2021 and beyond. We'll see what it looks like. But, yeah, we'll try and get a hold of Rick Kelly at some stage this week. In fact, off the SMS, not anything to do with Rick, 0416 90 50 52, where's the first outlet you're going to visit? Now that you'll be able to get out there and business will be open, which is fantastic for small business. This is great, Whitey, that a lot of people out there have been doing it very, very tough from a small business perspective, and the opportunity will now be out there to reopen, albeit under staged easing and restrictions, but reopen their businesses and their livelihoods, and that is magnificent. I feel for every one of them out there this morning that gives a chance to prepare for that tomorrow. Now, where are you going? Where are you going first up? Off the estimate, 0416 90 50 52. Where's that first little venture without any reasons to, well, outside the four reasons, which will no longer exist, to leave your house, Whitey? Where are you off to? That's what I want to know off the SMS. 0416 90 50 52.
Where will you go?
I'm just going around the corner. I'm just going up the little cafe up the road. That's what I'm going to do. They do a great little scrambled eggs with a Yarra Valley feta and a little bit of chilli flakes. And they do that. And I just want to sit there by myself. Just go there by myself at the back and have my little scrambled eggs. And then I'm going to do it with another person. I'm going to get another person and see them for the first time in a long time and be able to just sit across the desk from the table from them. That's what I'm going to do. Just around the corner, a little bit of Yarra Valley, chilli flake, bacon and eggs. Golden folded scrambled eggs.
Haven't you spent enough time by yourself? Don't you want to do that straight away with somebody else?
No, but I want the ambience of somebody else around, of movement around me. That's what I want. It's the energy of right. This is the thing. This is the thing. It's not just about other people, although we've learnt that other people are very important in our lives, particularly the ones we care about. But it's about the movement. It's the flow of life that's been interrupted, Whitey. It's not so much the connection of people, which is certainly an element of it, but it's the flow of life. It's the movement and the shaking of the world going around you. That's what the people miss through the energy of life, I reckon, as well. That's what I'm going to do.
Right, okay. Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
What are you doing? Don't say KFC.
No, please, I don't know. I don't... Yeah. Well, yeah, well, you can still go to KFC.
No, I know, but just don't say.
No. Well, I can't believe I haven't even been able to play golf yet. I've been too busy. I know
you're
a good friend of mine.
You are.
No, I know a good friend of mine played golf for the first time last week. We talked about that, Alistair Nicholson.
Did.
He had a 7 on the first and finished with a 75. He had 5 birdies.
He's a very good golfer.
But then we found out that there was no competition involved, so that wasn't as impressive. And then another good friend of mine played for the first time yesterday, and he played with a stranger. He hit the ball straight down the middle. This is a friend of mine. Hit the ball straight down the middle with his first. Second hit the ball to about 5 feet. And the bloke said to him, "Oh, geez, I didn't realise I was playing with a really good golfer. You can really play." And this person said, "I'm not that good. Don't worry about that." And he proceeded to have 4 putts from 5 feet. He said, "There you go. That's what I'm more like."
Then
away it all went. And it was back to normal in the space of about 5 minutes.
Did he end up with a 13? Any holes? 13!
13! it's amazing, this person said, how quickly life can go back to normal.
Off the SMS early doors. Juppy's got involved. He's doing a road trip to Houston's Barbecue in Keilor. Do you know that? Joey Pignataro, do you know that place? In Keilor? Houston's Barbecue? Juppy's making an effort from Bendigo to get there, so it must be good. I'll have to check that out. So will you, Frank, out the back. That's something you need to look into. Thank you, Juppy. Getting involved early doors on the SMS machine. Hey, Whitey, the water cricket. We've got Brad Kennedy and Sam Friedman coming up, so we don't want to get bogged down too much. But the water cricket, India have said that they'll quarantine and they'll do their business and they'll be happy to play for the summer. Is that what I read yesterday?
Yep. So it has changed. Rather than quarantining in Queensland, they're going to do it in Sydney, which has seen a change to the start of the summer as to where the one-day internationals will be played. So they'll be played in Sydney and Canberra. But things are starting to move in the right direction. You know, talking, and seriously for a moment, about some of the things that Dan Andrews said yesterday, there's now a genuine confidence there will be a crowd at the MCG. I don't think there's going to be 80,000, but there's going to be people there, which is really exciting. We saw yesterday, Half, that India announced their test squad. so again, feeling a bit more normal that's happening, not only their test squad, but they also announced their one-day international squad and their T20 squad. So they're coming. So I think that's really exciting. From a news perspective, Rohit Sharma has been left out of all squads. Now, he is coming off an injury. So they're saying that, look, we're not naming him at the moment. That doesn't necessarily mean that he won't be coming. It's just at this stage he's got to prove his fitness. So he was training with his IPL team in the last 24 hours. But, yeah, I don't know. I think he might come. But apart from that, all the other normal names that you'd expect are going to be coming. The other one is Ishant Sharma.
Hey, brother.
Now, he's... no, they're not. No, they're not. He has also been left out because he's been injured.
Right, so the Sharma boys.
I was trying to be serious for a moment.
Oh, sorry for just bringing a good bit of levity to the situation. Sorry for me thinking that the Sharma boys may have had some relation. Ishant and Rohit. Not to be, and got abused for it. Anyway. So... The Sharma boys aren't here, but they're going to be in Sydney, the Indians, and it's going to be a great summer of cricket. It's not so great South Africa at the moment, though. The board has resigned. The whole board has resigned.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
I think this has been going on for quite some time. There's all sorts of political dramas going on. That's not abnormal when it comes to cricket, but over there it's particularly intense with a number of things going on. So you might remember it hasn't been that long ago since Graham Smith got involved at sort of executive level. And there's a few others that they're trying to sort of bring back into the fold from a coaching perspective. But then there's all the whole... I mean, there's so many... it's a very sensitive issue when it comes to South African cricket, when it comes to quotas and all these sorts of things and other bits and pieces. So, I don't know too much about it, but it's a bit messy.
Brad Kennedy is not having a birthday today. I don't think he is, anyway. Let me just check that. He might be. We'll see. Probably not. No, he's not. He's a June birthday man. He's 46, Brad Kennedy, on the world of professional golf. Now, there was some suggestion that perhaps it was coming to an end, his time on the tour, but after a win in the New Zealand Open in March, he's found a new lease of life. He's been good enough to join us after the Zozo Championship in Sherwood over the weekend on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Brad.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Thanks for having me on board.
Good on you, buddy. Great to have you on board. Now, I need to ask, how are you feeling going into the Zozo on the weekend? Because, if I'm not mistaken, your last competitive round of golf was in March. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. I hadn't, after New Zealand Open, I actually didn't play golf for 6 months. So it was a bit tricky getting ready, and I sort of had 5 weeks preparation once I knew out. I was in Zozo Championship to get ready and get back to some sort of perform to play a tournament like that.
So how did you feel about that? Obviously, we're going back a long way now because you came off a tie for third at the PGA, the Queensland PGA, and then the Queensland Open, you were tied for third as well. You win the New Zealand Open, all sort of February, March. You were really playing good, rock-solid golf, winning tournaments, not easy to do. And then the world ends, effectively, from a golfing perspective, and you've got to take 6 months off. How did that hit your confidence?
I guess the mental challenge really was the fact that because I've been playing golf for 20-plus years competitively for all that time, just the fact that I didn't have anything competitive to do was a real struggle. And it took me quite a while to get through that. And once everything locked down, everyone else was in the same position, so I just sort of tried to get through it as good as I could and spent a lot of time with my family, which was great, and did a few other things to get prepared over the next few years. But, yeah, it was definitely a struggle early on, but as it got more and more towards the end of it, I actually was thinking I could do this full-time now. It's getting pretty comfortable.
So when you sort of spend 6 months not playing, do you get a chance to reflect back on your own golf career and sort of think, okay, well, this is now what's possible? Do you have a greater appreciation of the game?
I think it was I've always tried to look forward and look at opportunities and take those opportunities when I can. I've never felt like the game's owed me anything. I'm always trying to perform as good as I can, because like any professional sport or business, you can have one bad year and that's the end of it. So I was always appreciative of where I was and what I'd done, and never wanted to give that up. But I knew for me now, coming towards the end of my career, was for me now to practice and play and perform was all I need, a purpose and I need a timeline. And when everything shut down, that timeline disappeared. So for me, practicing wasn't as important then, and just sort of scaled it back and spent some quality time that I hadn't had over 20 years, and did some fishing, a lot of cycling, gym work, and spent time with friends. So that was a good time to relax and, I guess, reflect a little bit. But at the same time, I was looking at retiring at the end of this year, but now that's gone. I'm going to have to extend a few more to try and accomplish some things that I've still want to do through the golfing industry.
Yeah, I remember we spoke to you after you won in New Zealand and just talking about how all of a sudden, you know, things open up and you sort of change your goals a little bit and I guess your expectations. But when you weren't playing, having had that really successful run, did you put the clubs away for 3 months? You talked about sort of still practicing along the way, but did you have a clean break from the game for a while?
Yeah, pretty much didn't touch a golf club from New Zealand through till the first week of September. I had 6 months completely off golf at all, which was a long time, I know. But again, practicing for me now there's really need to be a purpose in place, and I don't play socially much anymore. So I need to. It's just a business for me now. So when all the tournaments disappeared, there was no reason for me to go and practice, and just had a good time off. And once I did get back, it was certainly took some time to try and get back to the competitive golf. And yeah, just that mental edge, I think, you lose when you're not playing competitively all the time. And to come over to the US and play at this level definitely made me have to get into that space pretty quickly.
Yeah, we're really anxious to ask you about what it was like playing with some of the biggest names in the game. But one question I wanted to ask you is, if Harf and I don't play for a few months, which often happens at times, and then we get back out, we're good fresh because we haven't got any bad habits in our game. What was it like when you first started swinging the golf club again? Did you go straight back to playing as you were, or did you feel you had a different swing? You'd got rid of some of the issues you had in your game? What was it like that first time?
To be honest, I was quite happy with where I started, and yeah, things came back reasonable. But it's more just the real sharpening up areas, chipping and putting, and just getting that swing. Probably the timing with my golf swing was out because I'd been doing a lot of riding and cycling and gym work just to keep fresh at my age, trying to chase around some of these young 25-year-olds on the golf course and be competitive. So that the fitness side of it was important, and my swing didn't change a whole lot, but it was definitely just that fine tuning of tempo and touch that takes the longest to get back.
Sam Friedman is part of the Friedman stable, and we don't get a chance to chat to Sam these days because he's massive business, and Felgate demands that he's the one that speaks to him. But we want a piece of him this morning because it's building up to a big period. Headquarters, of course, for the next week and a half for the Melbourne Cup Carnival is going to be magnificent. Today is Breakfast with the Stars, and Warning is doing some work at Flemington, and Sam's going to tell us all about it. Joins us on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Sam.
Morning, boys. How are you going?
We are well, thank you. Now, we had to headlock Michael Felgate to get access to you today. I hope you don't mind. he's very protective of his talent, isn't our man, Blue Eyes. But it's great to have you with us, because Warning is a horse we've all been watching in the build-up to the Melbourne Cup in Tuesday week. Of course, today is a pretty important piece of work. Just for those out listening on our program today, how important is this week out work in terms of a Melbourne Cup preparation?
Oh, it's pretty important because you get, you know, it's the last piece of work he'll do, and it's the last sort of thing you see as the trainer of, you know, how the horse is really going. And you know, we've got a pretty good grip on how Warning is going. You know, when he's working, he's not a particularly flash track worker. He's more of a game day horse, so I wouldn't be expecting him to be running any flash times this morning. But, you know, rider feedback is so important on this sort of piece of work. So, yeah, fingers crossed, he's going to work well, and we can look forward to next Tuesday.
Derby winners in the recent years haven't had enormous success in the Cups the following year. What's different about this fella?
Oh, well, hopefully he can have a bit of success. I don't know. It's very hard for a Derby winner to come back at four and compete in a race like that, it's a big step up. And, you know, you go from running against local three-year-olds who, you know, most of them in a spring Derby probably don't even stay at the 2500. So, and then you've got to come up in the spring and run against, you know, these superstar international horses that arrive on our shores. So it's sort of a big fish in a small pond in the three-year-old staying races, and now he's got to mix it with the best. So, look, he's been competitive this preparation so far, albeit, you know, Caulfield was probably his worst run, but for whatever reason, he just seems to hate it there. So it's back to Flemington off feet.
So I was going to ask you, Sam, about the confidence levels going in, because while he hasn't necessarily been winning, he seems to have been ticking along okay. What would your confidence levels be like going into next week, or is it just too hard to tell?
Yeah, well, I don't think he can be confident. I mean, we're confident going into a Derby, but going into a Melbourne Cup is just a whole different ball game. So I'm confident he'll run top 10. You know, beyond that, when you start to get into that top four, top five, you really need to be humming along. And I think given it's at Flemington and it's that 2 miles, he hasn't been out to the 2 miles, but he'd run a Jericho Cup trip if you asked him to, so that'll be no issue. But I'm hopeful that he can just be slogging it away, and if he can finish in the top five or six, we'd be absolutely wrapped.
So what do you do in relation to your competitors? Do you keep an eye on what's happening out at Werribee and keep a close eye on the sort of the form lines going in? Or as a trainer and the stable, are you just worrying about getting your horse right and you don't tend to worry too much about what's going on around you?
Yeah, I think probably when I was first starting working with Dad, I was worrying too much about, you know, what other horses were doing, what else was going to be in the race. And I was concerning myself a lot with the form and speed maps and all of that. And Dad sort of simplified it a lot. And it's sort of just said, you can only really worry about your own horse. You control what you can control, and the rest of it will sort itself out. So we're just worried about Warning and Steel Prince heading to the Melbourne Cup. And you know, we'll just hopefully draw barriers and they'll run the 2 miles and they'll put their best foot forward. One thing they are is very honest horses, so they never run a bad race. And so we're just worrying about them at this stage.
Yeah, I'm hurting a fair bit right now. It's been an awesome year. I just want to thank all the teammates, thank everyone involved in this year. It's been an awesome ride, so thank you.
Good work.
A very dusty Martin there last night at the Richmond B&F, the Jack Dyer Medal. He didn't even win it. It's taken out by Jaden Short, who's the Jack Dyer medalist for 2020. Lee Matthews would be happy that he got these votes right eventually for the Norm Smith medal, and Jaden Short took out the B&F. Rodney Eade knows a bit about Best and Fairest and those awards and this time of year because he's been a part of it as a player and a coach. He knows a fair bit about it. It's great to have him a part of our team. Rocket, good morning.
Morning, Daniel. How are you, mate? How are you?
Going well.
Going well?
We're good.
Good. Good.
We're good.
Enjoy the grand final?
Yeah, love the grand final. Particularly the start of the grand final, Rocket. It was almost old school. It was physical. It was a brutal contest early doors, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was a bit of carnage, wasn't there? It was a bit of worry for both sides. And then you hear later that Hooley had heard he nicked his calf as well. So obviously the Tigers got through that okay by the end of the game. But it was good. It was good physicality, which is great to see.
Hey, just on that, Rocket, because coaches all there have these planning meetings and the what-ifs and the scenarios about what might happen on the weekend. Do you ever plan for that one where you lose one of your key defenders early if you're Richmond or within the first 5 minutes and what you do about that? Have they ever come up in the what-ifs?
Probably not. You probably think of... the what-ifs generally are things go wrong, but not of a catastrophe. So, you're losing Boston, who's really in their... certainly in their best five players, to be able to him go down then gives you the scarier thought of it's easy enough to get another injury or a concussion. You could be really, really under the pump because Broad went off and it looked like he might come back on because of the concussion. It's a bit scary. It'd be a bit of heart flutters, I think, in the Tigers coach's box.
Yeah, that would. That's the worst possible outcome, I reckon, for a coaching situation, for the coach's box, to have one of your key strategic players, the structural players, go down in the first couple of minutes of a grand final. Surely that has to throw a cat amongst the pigeons.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And especially, I mean, have a look at the Tigers, because obviously we'll talk about tactics and what teams can change. Richmond don't normally change. They haven't got the capacity, but their forwards are forwards, their backs are backs, and their mids are mids. They don't really change their players. Like Blossom doesn't go forward, or Grimes doesn't go forward, or there's no forwards that'll go back. They generally are pretty settled. There's not many changes. So having Blossom, as you said, him and Grimes are probably the two key defenders. Him going out, it does throw it amongst the, as I said, the cat amongst the pigeons. So there's six defenders in them, would have seven, so there's six defenders would have to play most of the game, so there wouldn't be much of a rest. I think the scary thing would be if we get another one, what do we do? So,
is it one of the sort of... Sorry, Rocker, but is it one of the, I guess, not secrets to their success, but one of the reasons why Richmond's been so successful is that they do keep it simple, not just in positionally, but even just the way that they play, that under pressure, by keeping it fairly simple, they seem to respond really strongly in that situation?
I think that may be the case. I think that shows probably their system and their belief in each other is, I think as Chris Scott said pre-game, that you can plan to know what they're going to do. So, and they are predictable in that way, predictable in their unpredictability, if that's the right phrase. But it's an interesting one. I think we'll talk a bit later, but I think Geelong at half-time would have thought, oh, well, it's not broke. We don't have to fix it. But I would have thought that make a change or two then. I'm talking going the opposite way for them. You have a look at the Bulldogs. They're flexible. They throw their players around a bit. And we talk about that as a positive. So I think it's just knowing your own players, your own team, and then having confidence in what you're going to put into place. And you don't need to change much for them. I think other teams to change it around. I think what it is with Richmond, if you're in opposition, I think you need to throw them different looks at it. So if you get into the same mode, that suits them, because I think they will beat you at the fact of being predictable as far as having your players in the same spot. I think you need to throw them different looks at it. So I think it's horses for courses, mate, to be honest.
So I'm going to ask both of you, as coaches, is it too simplistic to say that Richmond has a simplistic way of playing? Because I think the headline about Richmond is that they're a surge team. They just get it forward, they just kick it forward, whatever they can do, and keep the ball in motion. Is it too easy to say, oh, that's... there's not many tactics to that. That's just instinctive footy. Is it? I'll be really interested in what you guys think of how they play and whether and why, perhaps why not, more teams don't replicate the way that they go about it, considering they've now won three of the last four premierships.
I certainly like the way they play. I think it is a bit too simplistic to say that, because they'll use angles going forward. They do use hands. They'll go corridor, so they... whenever a player receives a ball under pressure, he'll turn corridor side with the hands, and there's always runners. So they've got a good style. There's good support. It's just not bang it forward. What they do under... once there's three, four, five handballs, and then there's a bit of heat. I think it was a good one the other night where they handballed a lot and got it to Edwards, and he just kicked it forward because he knew the pressure was coming. So they seem to be well-trained that when there's real heat, let's get it going forward. Then when there's something you can't do with a footy, that's the time to get it going forward, where a lot of teams, a lot of players, have three, four, five handballs, then they'll go six and seven and eight and just draw the pressure. And I think that's good. I think they use the angles. They try it. They hit leading targets when they're given time and space. They switch the ball a lot out of the back half. And their tactics have improved a fair bit over the finals at stoppages. They've been beaten at stoppages. Mm. Martin, the way he's flipped out of stoppages, I don't think St Kilda coped with that really well. Brisbane didn't either. So I think it's the same personnel, but just doing a little subtleties at certain times of stoppages, and I think that's helped them as well.
Yeah, I really admire the way they play, because it looks... on the surface, wide, I think it does look as if it's
get the ball and just go without too much system. But there is always an outlet and an out option. And I think that's one of the great things in footy for great teams to have any level. Always give yourself an out. And Richmond have always got a player in position to just get the ball out to stop the flow and just gain possession if they need it. Because I think they want to keep the ball in motion, as we've seen for years now, Rocket. But they've always got the out if they need it. Even if that quick one under pressure, it'll go out on the angle to the 45 because they'll know someone will be there, probably on the outside of their opponent, and get first crack at that footy, even if it doesn't get to them cleanly. Clearly, behind the ball, they're really well-structured and they use it pretty well. And they get the handball across the nose to break that line, Rocket, which is one of their great strengths as well, really quickly from the back half. But the ability to have always someone in a position as a safety outlet, I think, is one of their great challenges, but great successes as a coaching staff to beat teams, because everyone is looking like they're going to just have to deal with manic ball movement going forward and deal with bodies at them. But they've always got a nice little sneaky out too to take the heat off when they need it.
So I think they do control the ball a bit. I think we're not giving them enough credit for that. But they're quite happy to have chaos ball, if we call it that way. Yep. Once we're under pressure, they're happy to soccer it, which is a great way to be, because why it stands up in finals is because there's a lot more pressure in finals. So therefore, they've practiced that, and that's their game style. Under heat, just get it going forward. We know where it's going. And as Harf said, they position themselves really well. They know if they're not involved in the contest where they need to be, how far off the contest, what side of their opponent they need to be, especially if they're a kick away and on the outside or the change of direction. But if they get quick hands out of stoppages or out of the contest, that they generally do look for targets and they'll use the angles. And I don't think we give them enough credit for that. But I think they'll sit back and they're not worried about that. But the thing I like is under real pressure, they don't try and do too much, which we see players and teams get into trouble when they try and do too much, try and take the world on, and they just get caught holding the ball. And I think they cope with that pressure well because they know they can just knock it on and get it going forward.
And I think that was the point, and I'm glad you mentioned it the way you did, Rocket, about, you know, because you always want to try and learn lessons from what the good teams did well in the highest of high-pressure situations. And whether it be the preliminary final when the game was close against Port Adelaide or the way that they were able to get themselves back into the game against Geelong, it just felt like under enormous pressure, the way that they play their football stands up a lot more than other teams that do feel like they're a little bit more structured and there seems to be a little bit more intricacies to their success in the way that they need to play. So I just thought that the way you've explained it's really quite good.
And I think for players, you get confidence knowing that it's okay to just kick it forward, and they're probably just reinforced. So you know if you're under real pressure, well, I don't have to do anything. And it's marvellous what pressure will create in your mind, because a lot of players, most players think, well, I've got to do something with the ball, and you'll see them hang on to it a bit longer, and you say, what did you do that for? Because he's looking for an option. He's looking to give to somebody, and if there's no one there, well, he's creating pressure for himself, where Richmond, it's okay to do that, just get it going forward. So they've got, so the lesser players, if that's right, their bottom six, are confident enough, well, it's not a mistake for me just to soccer the ball forward, get it going our way. So they feel that they're fitted in pretty well. So there's no mental pressure on them to perform that way.
Rocket Eads with us on a Tuesday morning. Thanks to Bocca Espresso, boccaespresso.com.au. Sound like Dusty Martin might have needed a few Bocca Espressos after the BNF last night. Rocket, to stay awake after a big party, I imagine, after the Premiership.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought he'd be mellow in that situation. I know he's a very quiet, humble sort of guy, but I think that's his playing field, isn't it, I think? So, look, he was certainly the difference. I think out of his three Norm Smiths, I think his first one was probably one that he may have lost. I think Hooley, there was conjecture on that. But he played well, so there's no drama. But his last two were certainly the one on Saturday night. He was best player, the most influential player in the ground. And they had plans for him, and he was able to overcome that. And I think that's the mark of a great player, isn't it? The plans they've had for him and what it is he's performed.
James is doing some great things. So you've been at Werribee this morning, doing some great things throughout the spring, and got a bit emotional when Dragon A was good enough to land the Cox Plate on Saturday, and I think there's been a bit of an update. James, good morning.
Morning, boys. How are we?
Going very well, thank you. How's the champ come through Saturday?
Yeah, as good as we could have hoped. if not better. He's really well. I've been on him twice in the race. Good condition. He knows he's won the race, and yeah, he's bouncing. He's in the zone.
Well, that's all very well and good, but we're hearing some things that today there's been some excitement out there at Werribee for Sir Dragonair. Tell us what you're seeing at the moment, James.
Oh, he's just, like I said, he's just in a good frame of mind. His condition's unbelievable. I can't believe how well he's come through a Cox Plate. You know, that's one of the probably best weight for age race in the world, and the way he's bounced through it is exceptionally well.
Now, James, you've always said the whole way along that he would be better in a Melbourne Cup than a Cox Plate. Sort of go back to Saturday first before we go forward to next Tuesday. Just your emotions. Now you've had some time to think about it, about sort of being involved in a horse that goes on to win a Cox Plate in its preparation.
Yeah, it was more the emotion that, obviously, like I touched on, my career ended suddenly and it was out of my control. But being any sportsman or athlete, when he went over the line, it sort of sunk in for the first time that I'd never get to that feeling again of, not that I won a major, but I did win 5 Group 1s, and that feeling that goes through your body when you go over the line at that top level is something that, you know, will never happen to me again. So that's why I got emotional. And it was just great to be, you know, you're there, but you're so far away. So, yeah, it was just, yeah, something that I was surprised, actually, but it was like I said, it actually sunk in that feeling of being, you know, achieving at the top level was going to, I would never experience it again.
So you're a week out from the Melbourne Cup. You've ridden Sir Dragonair this morning. Tell us what you're asked to do with the horse, and you sort of, are your expectations going up even further heading into a Melbourne Cup now? Not just what happened on Saturday, but what's happened this morning?
Yeah, look, obviously, big, you know, tick in the box for him to, you know, come out and win a Cox Plate. And as you hear what Bossy said, it was sort of great that he relayed what I said, that he's a horse that can maintain a gallop for a hell of a long time. And Bossy felt that the horse hadn't got to top speed in the Cox Plate. So you would think that he's going to suit him down to the ground over 2 mile at Flemington. But a realistic fact and part about it is you've still got to run 3,200 metres. It's a big difference between 32 to 2,000. There's a big difference even between 2,400 to 32. A lot of horses can run 24, but they can't run 2 miles. So he still has to tick that box, but he's breeding stage as well. Like I said, the horse has done everything perfect. And this morning, he just went a real nice, strong bowling canter of the A-track there around Corfu, which is about, probably 1,800 metres long. And yesterday, he just had a bit of a trot and a canter, make him feel good. I can tell you right now, he's feeling good.
Clint McFarlane from the Herald Sun. He's got the latest with us from player movement activities. The free agency period starts Friday. Trade next week. It's going to be very, very busy for blokes like Macca, and he'll be the best covering it all for us on The Breakfast Club. Macca, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, guys. And Rocket was absolutely right when he said it's game on now with trades, isn't it? We haven't officially started yet, but the shadow boxing has well and truly started.
Now, there's a couple of key players. Joe, Jeremy, and Adam, I suppose, are the big three through the next little period, because the Adam Treloar situation still baffles me, Macca, I must admit. Yesterday, we were reading with great interest that Collingwood have told him they don't want him, effectively. He's desperate to stay. Where does that end up?
It's a bizarre scenario, isn't it, guys? And I suppose it comes back to a bit of trust between the two groups, doesn't it, in a sense? Treloar wants to stay. He's actually been very vocal about that. But you know who we haven't heard from in this whole scenario? And that's Collingwood. To say, you know, the Bulldogs are saying about Josh Stuncliffe, we want him to stay. He's not going anywhere. He's contracted. Adam Treloar's got 5 more years. I think we said this a couple of weeks ago, guys. Say it again. 5 more years on huge money. And the Pies aren't out there with this back-ended deal. They're keen to get this back-ended deal off the book, which is extraordinary when you think about it. They only entered in and recommitted him to the club, about 12 months ago or so to do that. So they're very quiet, which means there's movement behind the scenes, guys.
So, Macca, I'm interested in knowing a little bit more about this with Treloar. Is it a simple case of, because of COVID and the drop in salary cap, whatever it's going to be, that he's just too expensive to have on their books? Is it an issue with the fact that they now don't think he can play as well as they thought he could play? Is it related to his body and the injuries he's had? Why is it that there seems to be a change in the space of 18 months on one of their highest paid players?
Yeah, you know what it is? I reckon it's an element of all three there, Whitey, in a sense. And certainly the money is the main factor. We know with COVID that we haven't got a deal yet with the AFL and the Players Association about knowing what the salary cap is going to be next year. So that's still not going to start. We're not going to have that resolution before trade actually starts. But if you look at it also, his body issue is a concern. Mind you, I spoke to him only 3 or 4 weeks ago, and he said that he feels like he's on top of these hamstring issues, that it's not an ongoing thing that he's going to have that is a concern. But also, I think the fact that his partner is, and this is probably only a minor factor, the fact that his partner is going to be out of the state this year next year, for the netball season as well, I think that's a big issue as well. I think it's a combination of all three. But, gee, they'd want to get this right, Collingwood, if they do choose, you know, take a pick five for him. They've had some issues with their drafting in recent years. You know, you look back, and it's going back a while now, but Schoenberg and Nathan Freeman, nothing went right with either of those guys. And we also, the Pies, they also lost, you know, 2 first-round picks with Dane Bean. So want to be a right call there, you'd think, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Harf, I'm going to ask you this question. Does it have a potential to be an issue that you've got one of your best players and one of your more popular players in the team that is essentially being pushed out? What does that do potentially culturally to a place?
Yeah, I don't think it helps. That's what I don't think it does. And we've seen it through the years. And there was obviously the classic example of the Bombers back in the early 2000s with the Carousel of Blomfield. Who's the other one?
Heffernan.
Yeah, now that's a 3-for-1 sort of deal. That can really give you a body blow to the group. But a guy like Adam Treloar, who seemingly is one of the most professional guys going around, Macca, pretty popular, a really important player for them, to be effectively pushed out, and not just pushed, like really heaved out the door. I imagine it does cause a little bit of rumblings within the playing group, but obviously there's a reason. It must be salary cap related, you would think, Macca, for this to be getting so dramatic so quickly, considering he's been a really good player for a long time, Adam Treloar.
He has, and if you look at it, but then again, you've got to blame the club in this sense if it is a salary cap issue. They were the ones who actually signed him on the deal and obviously heavily back-ended it as well. It's very heavily back-ended, and that's a huge concern. It runs through to end of 2025, and next year it's going to hit the high 800s. So that's a lot of money. But you know what? The club entered into that agreement with Adam in good faith, and Adam entered into it in good faith as well. You're spot on about the players. If you were a player there at the moment, you'd be wondering, am I too out the door? And there's a few others that have got to be a little bit concerned about what's going to happen with Collingwood, but also in a fan's perspective as well. He's a very popular player, Adam Treloar. So I think you'll find a little bit of backlash from the fans there. You really want Collingwood to come out and say what they're thinking at the moment, because at the moment they're very, very quiet.
Hasn't been pretty quiet from the Magpies. But Jordan DeGoey looks like he'll stay for another couple of years. Macca get himself to free agency and then probably test the market. Is that what we're reading?
Yeah, I think you're spot on with there. And it's an interesting scenario, and it draws a bit of a parallel with Dusty in my mind as well. If you remember back to 2013 when Dusty did the tour of GWS and was looking around and trying to get as much money as he possibly could. Well, like Jordan DeGoey this year, he found that the market, you know, wasn't going to give him what he thought he was worth. So I think the ball's back in Jordan DeGoey's court now. If he signs that 2-year deal with Collingwood, which we expect him to really get himself right, get his body right. And I'm not going to say he's going to go on and be Dusty Martin, but Dusty got a huge contract at the end of that, and now that's what Jordan will be thinking he can do.
Now, the Cats had a bad day on Saturday at the Gabba, although one of them did okay. Jordan Clark won the grand final sprint, walked away with a couple of gorillas, I think, in the Sky Rocket, which is a good result for the young fella. Couldn't get a game, unfortunately, and in the end, probably one of the reasons his dynamic running was one of the things they could have used out there, the Cats, on Saturday night. Is there interest from the Giants in Jordan Clark, or what about out west?
There's definitely interest from the Giants, but he has no interest in going to the Giants at this point. If he goes anywhere, he'll go out west. There's been huge interest from Fremantle and a little bit from West Coast as well, but Jordan Clark would prefer to stay at Geelong. He feels like there is an opening there for him, and I'm still a little bit surprised he didn't play enough this year. He had obviously that shoulder issue and that as well, but if there was a situation that he does leave, it would be Fremantle more than anyone else. And, you know, I think he would prefer to stay at Geelong, but if you could do a deal that lands Jesse Hogan somewhere at the GWS, it gets Clark back to Fremantle and it frees up Geelong a little bit there as well, that'd be an interesting scenario. But at this stage, He wants to stay at Geelong, but massive interest from Fremantle.
What about the year of Thomas Randall, who's a young motorsport driver, racing driver, who we spoke to at Tail and Bend, testing day at Tail and Bend, I think it might have been at the start of the year. He's gone on to win the Dunlop Super 2 Championship in the world of motorsport in Australia after a win on the weekend at Bathurst. He's the champ. He's the 2020 Supercar Series 2 champion, and he's been good enough to join us on the Breakfast Club again. Thomas, good morning. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Good morning to you guys as well. Thanks for having me.
Mate, unbelievable scenes from you. We talked about a big year. We've gone through a pretty rough patch in Victoria here, as you well know. You've gone through not only that, you've gone through testicular cancer was diagnosed at the start of the year. You had chemo on that. And one of your great quotes for the year, I think, is this means I'll have to go undergo chemo to get rid of the bastard, you said in an interview earlier in the year. You get back into the seat in the car and you're now the Series 2 Supercar champion. Can you believe what's happened in 2020 to you?
No, not really. No, I think if you put a script in front of me back in January and said, look, this is going to happen to you, and then we're going to have a global pandemic, and then everything's going to shut down, and then we're going to do some E-Series racing. Oh, and then we're going to get back into it, but then you're going to have to quarantine. Oh, but if you don't do that, you could fly to, maybe go to Queensland, drive up there, stay there for 3.5 months, and then race at Bathurst and win the championship. Like, no, I don't know how you'd predict it. And in all of that, I also got myself a puppy. So, certainly, I don't know how you predict that.
Hey, well, let's get to the main item here. What sort of puppy did you get?
A Labrador Retriever. He is just a gorgeous little thing. I named him Harvey. And, I got him from a breeder in New South Wales while I was in Queensland. And then I've driven him back to Victoria. So, certainly been a hell of a journey for him as well.
Good old Harvey, riding shotgun with you. That's magnificent. Great stuff. Yeah. How important was driving and racing to you to get your mind off what you were going through from a health perspective?
Oh, it was massively important. I mean, the main goal was to be on that grid of Bathurst, you know, and we did everything we could to get there, and we did. But it was so difficult with the pandemic because, I mean, I was going through my own personal issues, and then everything, all the racing was shut down. So it made it difficult. But, I mean, I guess when you look in perspective, it was so many worse things that are going on in the world. I mean, to have racing put on hold is there's people that are losing their jobs, losing their livelihoods, people struggling with mental health, depression. And I think really racing, when you look at the grand scheme of things, it's not that important. But for the Supercars Championship to actually have been able to get their feet back on the ground and restart the championship and run Super 2 as well, I think it's just a credit to them, and it's also a big credit to my team and also my sponsors for staying on board and getting to finish the season. I think it's just a mammoth effort from everyone.
So Thomas, the one question I wanted to ask you more than anything else is, are you 100% clear of cancer now? Where does that all sit from a health perspective?
So I've been doing some scans every 2 months. We've just been monitoring my body to see if there's been any changes, and it seems like that they are probably going to be doing another operation because they want to remove some lymph nodes that are in my body, and they're unsure what they are at the moment. It's sort of stable, but they think that better out than in, if that makes sense. So then they can take that to the lab and they'll be able to see exactly what it is. And if they all come back clear, then I'll know for sure that, we can move on and I can focus on the rest of my life, which would be great.
So with that sort of still going on, that still, that uncertainty to a point, I mean, it's quite an incredible achievement that you've been able to win the title under those circumstances.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I mean, it's interesting because I feel completely healthy and I feel fit, but then you do these scans and, they kind of show a little abnormality in the lymph nodes. But I guess one good thing is that over these last 8 months, which it has been now, is that we've been able to track it. You know, it hasn't been getting significantly worse. And, I mean, if it had been, I would have been straight back on a plane or driven straight back to Melbourne. But it's also given me a lot of time to accept it. And I mean, back in January, it was all very daunting, the whole experience. But now I've sort of learned to live with it, and it's just the way it is. I mean, I know how lucky I am as well. And I think once I get through this next operation, I'll just be kicking it up the backside.
Shield season started with a bang for lots of players last week, and it was good to watch. It's been going a couple of weeks now, and one young man who is making headlines across the nation is from WA. Cameron Green is his name. 197 last week was just magnificent batting, to the point where the whole cricket world is focusing on his performance, and who knows what it might lead to when he joins us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Cam.
Morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Good on you, buddy. Now, you are in really good form. We had Whitey doing some commentary for the cricket.com.au feed last week. He's been a big fan of your work for the last little while. And he was talking about, now, I must admit, I didn't see it ball for ball. He was talking about your 197 as one of the most superb innings he's seen in a long time. How did you rate it?
Yeah, obviously I'm pretty proud of it. But obviously, yeah, the wicket was in our favour. But they came pretty hard all day, so yeah, I take a lot out of it.
So when you're out there and you're feeling it, obviously the wicket was in your favour, as you say, so you had an advantage there. But when you're feeling it and you know you're in rhythm, what's that like? Because you've been in really good form for the last 12 months in Shield cricket, and obviously the start of a new season is a nice time to get some runs as well. But what's that feeling like when you're in the zone out there?
Yeah, I think a lot of batsmen say the same thing. It's kind of like when you're not really thinking, you're just batting, you're just enjoying it. Everything feels like it's in a nice flow. Yeah, it's pretty hard to explain, but yeah, you're not thinking a whole lot.
I talked to Half about this on our program last week, watching the innings, about how while the pitch was reasonably easy to bat on, just to have such an experienced attack throw so many different things at you to see how you would cope with mentally, and you did extremely well in absorbing all of that pressure. Take us through what that was like.
Yeah, I think first in New South Wales, they really make you earn your 100. So when you're on about 80 or 90, they come around the wicket and just put a leg side field and basically bump the hell out of you. So, yeah, it's not very enjoyable, to be fair. You're pretty much like, oh, damn it, like, kind of wish I wasn't on 80, but then I wouldn't be getting every ball going past my head. But, yeah, that was probably the main one, kind of like keeping calm because you're so close to your 100, to not just play a couple of rash shots to try and get there quickly. Yeah, keeping calm, just working through it, and, yeah.
And so you got out three short of a double century, and the same thing happened like it did when you got close to three figures, that you were there for a while and they really made you earn it. How disappointed were you? And now you've had some time to reflect on it. How do you look back on that innings now?
Yeah, at the time, I think it was just a bit of a missed opportunity. You bat for nearly a day and a half and get so close, and then yeah, just miss out. So, yeah, obviously it was disappointing at the time, but now I kind of look back on it being really proud. Yeah, I think there's a lot to take out of it. It's my highest score ever. So, but yeah, hopefully it just makes me more determined to get there again.
Did you hit it?
You batted on... yeah, good question.
Did I get any bad in it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh no!
Yeah.
What a disaster! After 438 balls, you get a dodgy LB on 197.
I know. That kind of was mixed into it. That's probably why I was pretty emotional after. But I've had a lot of time to think about it, and it's just what cricket is, I guess.
You said it's your highest score, and it's a super impressive score, as Whitey said. Against that attack, it's a fantastic achievement. Batting for that long, day and a half, effectively, you're out there. A, have you done that before in any level of cricket? And B, how draining is that mentally to have that concentration going for so long?
Yeah, no, I haven't done that either. it's kind of just when you're in the slow state, you don't really know you're batting for that long until the day's actually done. I think just the only hard bit is like you kind of go through patches where you just want to score every ball. You get really anxious, and it's just working with your partner at the other end to get through those. But then after that, it's not too bad. You're pretty exhausted by the end of the day, though.
I'm sure.
Well, as Huff said, 438 balls, but you batted on day two, day three, all of day three, and some of day four. So for someone doing that, Cam, at 21 years of age, is quite remarkable. Before we sort of look forward, what did you learn that you perhaps didn't know about yourself before that innings?
Well, probably that I'm able to do it.
Yeah,
I thought I probably didn't have that restraint to not play like a rush shot all day. That's probably what I learned about myself, that I could do it, basically.
Yeah, so what I'm interested in is dealing with the pressure of expectation in such a young career. So you've only just recently turned 21. You made your first class debut at 18. There's been a lot spoken about you for a long time, and the bar, you just keep raising the bar. How are you dealing with that pressure of expectation?
Yeah, I'm going okay. I haven't really gone through a bad patch since I've hit the first 100, so I'm just kind of going with the wave, trying to go with the flow of doing well. And for some reason, it's just paying off at the moment, but I'm trying to keep a pretty level head. Because I know, cricket doesn't owe you anything, so as soon as you think you're better than you are, it catches up to you. So, yeah, just trying to keep a level head.
Let's talk Melbourne Storm after their magnificent victory on Sunday night against the Penrith Panthers. 26-20 in the end it was, and I'm sure they're still celebrating. I hope they are. They deserve it. Jason Riles is an assistant coach of the Storm. Joins us. Good morning, Jace.
How are you, boys?
We're going all right, buddy. How you doing?
Yeah, not too bad.
It sounds like you're a little bit worse off than not too bad at the moment, Jace.
Not too bad at all. It's been a couple of days now, so we've enjoyed ourselves the last couple of days. So, looking forward to getting back to Melbourne over the next couple of days.
Well, I'm sure you are. I mean, we hear the stories. We heard Cam Smith talking about it after the game and Craig as well. It's 5 months on the road, which is an extraordinary amount of time for any group of people, but it's such a large organisation like a footy club and all the staff. Has that been probably the theme for the conversations post-game, that how difficult it's been and what a challenge it's been and how rewarding and satisfying it is to achieve what you've done so far?
Yeah, not really, because I think before it, we were all talking about how big a task it was to sort of stay here for the last couple of months. So it was just good to get through the end of it, and it was a big relief at the end to get what the players deserve.
Did it get to a point where it was like, this is just going to be too hard? We were talking yesterday about your quick trip up to Albury early days and to be away for such a long time. How did you get through it all?
No, I think we just lived it day by day, to be honest with you, because we didn't have any other choice. So it was, at the end of the day, it was just basically just get through each week and each day, and look forward to we had a game each week and we had a result to sort of get through. So at the end of the day, we just sort of looked at each week and we got through that and sort of worked through that and then got through the next week. So it was, that's all we look forward to.
So the game itself, Jase, obviously an outstanding start, 22-0 at halftime, and things were looking pretty good. Then it got a bit tight, deep, with a couple of sin bins, which probably didn't help the cause. 13 against 11 is never a good thing against a good team. How nervous were you late?
Yeah, it was quite surreal at the time. So at the time, it was, I thought we were going to, it was going to be one of those games where you enjoyed at the end of it. But at the end of it, it was 10 minutes to go, and we were quite nervous there at the end. So it was, but I think the boys did the work early, and
It was one of those games where we thought we were going to get away with it early, but it was one of those things where we got quite nervous at the end, but you know, we were lucky enough to get away with it.
Has the chair, has it survived? I'm just a bit worried about the chair that was kicked rather aggressively by the coach.
You didn't see half of it because, he was quite animated early. So, you caught the end of it. But I think Justin Langer kicked his chair in that TV show that you've seen like during the year. But I think Crow tried to add to that. So it was one of those things that, we didn't see half of it, but it was good to get away at the end.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.